tonight on Arena. Tim Burgess on why he just loves David Bowie's 1971 album, Hunky Dory. And we look at season 4 of Fargo. Five one double 51 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Take a look at the long man, beating up the wrong guy. Oh man, wonder if you'll ever know who's in the best-selling shallow. Is there life on Mars? How many times have you listened to Bowie's Life on Mars on whatever streaming platform it is that you happen to use in recent times? Quite a few, I'd hazard to guess. But how often have you listened to that track as part of listening to the entire album, Hunky Dory? Not as many, I would hazard to guess. And I know that a lot of you will already be annoyed at me for fading it during the guitar solo. But, you know, I want to talk to the man who's going to persuade us to listen to the entire album with him. Tim Burgess of The Charlatans will be running one of his infamous Twitter listening parties in conjunction with the festival. That's the Dublin Bowie Festival. And he'll be joined, Tim, by Spiders from Mars drummer Woody Woodmansey, legendary keyboardist Rick Wickman, and producer Ken Scott to celebrate Hunky Dory, which turns 50 this year. Ooh, there you go. I'm delighted to be joined by Tim Burgess. As I read the 50 there, I got a bit of a shock myself. Did I hear a groan from you as well, Tim?
Yeah, how are you doing?
Not too bad. How are you? You love Hunky Dory.
I do, yeah. It's my favourite David Bowie record. Obviously, you know, he's done, well, all his records are amazing, but this is my favourite.
And had you done it as part, let's, for people who don't know what your listening parties are, let's just set that out. Explain what you've been doing on Twitter, and it all came out of lockdown. Some great things, in fact, have come out of this awful thing that is coronavirus and the lockdowns associated with us. Explain what you were doing with your listening parties.
Well, on the 23rd of March, I started the listening party, and the first one I did was a Charlatans record, Some Friendly. I thought I'd start at the beginning. And, you know, I needed to get other people on board. So Alex Kapranos was the first person to do, and he did Franz Ferdinand's debut. And then Dave Rowntree from Blur. And basically what the idea is that we put an album on. Everybody all across the world puts an album on at the same time. And someone who's involved in the making of that album tweets along as we listen.
And, you know, let's just say who you had on, or who certainly who had to give you a couple of tweets along the way just before Christmas.
Well, Paul McCartney, and before him, Kylie Minogue.
Wow. Yeah, well, the Paul McCartney on McCartney 3 was the one that I think I got particularly excited about when I saw it.
It was so great.
And the important thing here, Tim, is the album, really. That's what you're getting at, isn't it? Please listen to the album. Don't, and I'm guilty of it myself, I'm sure we're all guilty of it. Then, yeah, you know, I like that track and I like that track. I'll stick them up as part of a playlist, but I won't listen to the entire album. Why do you want us to kind of get back into that way of thinking, of listening to the full album?
Well, I think that it shows what the intentions are of the artist making the record. I mean, you know, nobody just wants to write singles all the time, or else people would just write greatest hits albums. They write a record that kind of explores a few areas that, a single track or an album full of hits doesn't do, you know. So it wasn't my intention to do that. Mm. But what happened is that after the listening parties were going for maybe a week or something like that, people would say, oh my goodness, you know, I've just not listened to an album in its entirety for years. Mm-hmm. Because people don't have the time. And obviously with COVID, all people had was time, especially in the first lockdown.
Yeah.
And you know, basically, people were just surprised that they hadn't heard albums in their entirety for a long time, you know, with playlists and everything like that. And everyone kind of, you know, wanting to do their own mix playlists and things like that. It just, people have just got out of the habit, I suppose. I mean, and there is an artistry in making an album.
Yeah, and even the time that can be spent discussing, and I'm sure you had this in the Charlatans, and every band has had it, the track listing, the order of the songs. Why does that go on what would be side one of the album, and why does that go on what would be side two of the album? And OCDs have kind of changed that a little bit. What do you think, or where do you think Bowie was at when it came to Hunky Dory?
He was obsessed by the Beatles and about to lead us all into a new kind of progressive or a progressive rock kind of phase or progressive pop.
And he we were coming out of The Man Who Sold the World, the 1970 album. So they were only a year on from that, effectively, although it was the end of 1971 when he released the album. In classic Bowie fashion, how big a change was this?
Well, I mean, you know, I have to say that I'm a little too young to have noticed what exactly he was doing, but I can only guess through looking back that he was just, this was a very concise record. This was influenced by, Warhol. It was, he was really, in his stride as a songwriter, someone who was who developed a craft of how to write songs, and he knew how to prolong the wait for a chorus. Life on Mars is just one of the greatest choruses of all time. You have to wait.
you do have to wait for it, and you should really wait for the guitar solo. I know you were probably groaning when I did that as well, but I wanted to talk to you. However, I mentioned Changes, which is as good a reason as any to give a little bit of this. Changes. Turn and face the strange. Changes. Don't want to be a richer man. Just leaving a little bit of that playing along, because we get the rumble of the keyboard underneath and we get a bit of the drumming as well, which is Tim Burgess of the Charlatans speaking to me this evening about what he is doing for the Dublin Bowie Festival this year, which is one of his listening parties with David Bowie's Hunky Dory. And who do you have along with you but drummer and keyboardist for the album? The two of them, in fact, isn't it, Tim?
Rick and Woody, and then Ken Scott, the producer, who I think, has made a huge contribution to the album, and the fact that it sounds so fresh even now,
Yeah, because I know Woody Woodmansey was in with us last year at around about this time, before any of us knew anything about lockdowns, and Tony Visconti, in fact, was in with him as well. Tony, I know, was part of this year's Bowie Festival as well. Phenomenal insight from both of them into the way Bowie even approached songs, how he approached performing, all of that side of things. What are you hoping to have as part of that conversation with both Rick Wakeman, as you say, the keyboardist, Ken Scott, and Woody Woodmansey, the drummer?
I guess a tremendous insight into the making of the album. We weren't there. No one was there apart from them too. In our world, in the world of this listening party, in the world of this festival, so they are the keys to this glorious door.
Yeah, and as you say, many of us who may be big Bowie fans subsequent to that, perhaps a little bit too young to have understood what was going on in 1971, but it's great to get those insights now in 2021, 50 years on. Let's hear what Bowie himself had to say about this album.
I've never been very proud of the whole Hunky Dory album, actually. I thought, well, this is really good. This is a good album. And you know something? I think the other interesting thing about that album, including that song, is that, again, they felt great to play on stage. They were such easy songs to work on stage that it was really a joy singing them. I enjoyed them. And I keep finding that I do go back to songs from that album to do on stage, even now, things like Quicksand I've done, you know? Queen Bitch I've done. I think that really that my subject matter hasn't really changed over the years. That I'm still, in a way, writing Life on Mars all these years later, you know?
That's amazing to hear him say that about Life on Mars, isn't it?
Wow. Wow. It's just great to hear his voice, isn't it, you know?
He mentions there about live performance and how important these songs were. I presume you were a little bit older later into the 80s and the 90s when perhaps you might have been at the odd gig. Did you get to see him live? Do you remember any specific experiences around that, Tim?
I did. We actually played, I think it was his last show that he ever did in the UK. So we played at the Isle of Wight. Charlatan supported him. We all met him before he went on stage. And he was wonderful. I introduced myself as Tim Burgess, and he said, "I know."
Yeah.
And I was kind of a bit, obviously very, a little bit jittery after that, really, a little bit. But I walked towards the stage with him, and he went on stage and did the best. I think, best shot I've seen, really.
It is extraordinary. I've heard more than you recount situations like that where they're going up, introducing themselves, feeling rather nervous and jittery, and he said, "Oh, I know you, and I know your music, and I know what you've been doing," and that it is, there was a kind of a, he wasn't, there was no big starriness about him, that there was a real ordinary guy, despite, you know, that kind of aloof nature that we get in some of the characters or the personas that he may have had. That's not what the real man was.
Well, no, because, you know, we when you're backstage at a festival, you know, everybody has, everybody has their dressing room and all that kind of stuff. And lots of artists like to be separate. But David Bowie didn't. He kind of like would knock on people's doors and sort of like, you know, say, "Hey, how's it going?"
It's disarming even to hear it expressed in that way. In that way, we'll finish up, Tim, I think, by listening to one of your own tracks. But let me just tell people that Tim Burgess, who's been speaking to us there this evening, will be, along with drummer Woody Woodmansey, keyboardist Rick Wakeman, and producer Ken Scott, listening through the entire David Bowie album, Hunky Dory, the 1971 album. That's on Sunday, January the 10th at 9 p.m. as part of the 6th Dublin Bowie Festival, which runs from January the 10th through until 17th. And dublinbowiefestival.ie will give you all of the details there. But since you're talking about what Woody and Ken will be able to tell you about the making of the album since they were there, I want to play The Only One I Knew. So talk to me about what you remember about this huge single, obviously, for you guys, from the Some Friendly album. Tell me what you remember of the making, particularly of this song within the making of that album.
Well, the making of the song, I remember it was always an instrumental. It was an instrumental we were working on for a couple of days, and we used to work really fast then, I just remember I was at home. I was staying with my mum and dad, and I decided to go and get a packet of cigarettes. So I walked out of the house, and I got about half a mile towards the garage, the closest garage to my mum's house, and I got this melody in my head, which is the chorus. Mm. And I didn't have any way of recording it. I didn't have my dictaphone. I'd left it at home. I didn't have a pen and paper. So I ran all the way home to my mum's house and recorded it on the dictaphone. And that was the first recording ever of The Only One I Know. And I just always think to myself, what would have happened if I decided to just go and get the cigarettes and not bother about the melody?
There you go. And children, boys and girls, this was in the day when you didn't have a mobile phone in your pocket that had a recording device on it. If you didn't have the dictaphone, you weren't recording. Tim, exactly. Listen, lovely to speak with you this evening, and thanks so much for that story. And let's go in and hear what happened, what you sang into that little dictaphone when you got back to your mum's house, and enjoy the listening party on the 10th. Thanks, Tim.
Thanks, man. Bye-bye.
The only one.
The only one I know there from the Some Friendly album from the Charlatans. And before that, we were speaking to Tim Burgess. And just to remind you of the details of that, listening to the Hunky Dory album of David Bowie, Sunday the 10th of January at 9 p.m. You can find out all of the events for this year's Dublin Bowie Festival will be online January the 10th through until the 17th. You can find out full details on dublinbowiefestival.ie. 25 minutes past 7 on Thursday night's Arena. In a huge coup for TG Cahir, it has won the rights of the fourth season of Fargo, the TV series based on the Coen brothers' 1996 film of the same name. Arlene Hunt and John Maguire, both Fargo fans, have been watching Series 4, but before we get their views on that, let's take a trip down memory lane, or should I say nightmare lane, because when it comes to Fargo, be it the film or the series, terrible things happen to people living in cold, remote places because they decide to enter pacts with Satan himself. In the original film, it was the desperate car salesman, Jerry Lundegaard, played by William H. Macy, who did the deal with the devil. He was in a desperate situation, does a deal with two hitmen from Fargo, a town in North Dakota, to kidnap his wife for a ransom, hoping that his father-in-law will pay up. But as we hear in this clip, things go wrong. One of the hitmen, Carl, played by Steve Buscemi, calls Jerry with, be warned, a pretty foul-mouthed update on the crime.
Jerry Lundegaard.
All right, Jerry, you got the phone to yourself?
Well, yeah.
You know who this is?
Well, yeah, I got an idea. How's that Sierra working out for you?
Circumstances have changed, Jerry.
Well, what do you mean?
Things have changed. Circumstances, Jerry, beyond the acts of God, force majeure.
What the? How's Jean?
Who's Jean?
My wife.
Oh.
What the?
She's all right, but there's three people up in Brainerd who aren't so okay, I tell you that.
What the heck are you talking about? Let's just finish this deal up here.
Blood has been shed, Jerry.
What the heck do you mean?
Three people in Brainerd.
Oh, jeez.
That's right, and we need more money.
What the heck are you talking about? What do you fellas got yourself mixed up in?
We need more
money. This was supposed to be a no rough stuff type deal.
Don't ever interrupt me, Jerry. Just shut the fuck up.
Well, I'm sorry, but I don't...
I'm not going to debate you, Jerry. I'm not going to debate. We now want the entire 80,000.
Oh, for Christ's sake, here.
Blood has been shed. We've incurred risks, Jerry. I'm coming into town tomorrow. You have the money ready.
Now, we had a deal here. A deal's a deal.
Is it, Jerry? You ask those three poor souls up in Brainerd if a deal's a deal. Go ahead, ask them.
The heck do you mean?
The heck you mean? I'll see you tomorrow.
The TV series Fargo then began in 2014. It was the brainchild of writer and director Noah Hawley. And in the first season, the innocent man turned bad was Lester Nygaard, played by Martin Freeman, who accidentally meets hitman Lorne Malvo, played by Billy Bob Thornton. And as we hear in this clip, becomes influenced by his philosophies.
Your problem is you spent your whole life thinking there are rules. There aren't. We used to be guerrillas. All we had is what we could take and defend. The truth is you're more of a man today than you were yesterday.
How do you figure?
It's a red tide, Lester, this life of ours. The shit they make us eat. Day after day, the boss, the wife, etc., wearing us down. If you don't stand up to it, let them know you're still an ape. Deep down where it counts, you're just gonna get washed away.
Season 2, then, was a prequel to the events of Season 1. A young couple, Peggy, played by Kirsten Dunst, and Ed, played by Jesse Plemons, are left to cover up a hit-and-run accident, little knowing that the victim has strong gangland roots. Ed has ground down the body of the victim in his butcher shop, and so they have to re-crash their car.
You sure about this plan?
It'll work. Like I said, my uncle used to drive his truck and drink old Milwaukee, and you know, insurance don't want to pay for accidents when you're drunk, so he came up with this plan. Every crack up, he'd drive his truck to some deserted spot till he sobered up, fake a new accident to cover the damage he did drinking.
Well, it's creative.
So that's what we do. We cover the damage, file a report, and then, I mean, that should do it. We got rid of the... I mean, the guy's all grown up, and you burned his clothes, you said, so... Once the car's fixed, it's... We're free.
And so on to season three, where the action revolves around brothers Ray and Emmett Sussey, both played by Ewan McGregor. It ends up with Emmett killing his brother Ray. And here he confesses his crime to policewoman Guria Bugle, played by Carrie Coon.
I killed him.
Your dad?
Ray. First I tricked him. Then I killed him. Like no days had passed, like one thing goes and then another, like you whack a tennis ball back and forth.
Killed him where?
In the den of his shithole apartment. Framed picture, puzzle on the wall, like some six-year-old so proud he had to hang it up. Christmas Eve. You think there's a special level of hell for people that kill their loved ones on Christmas Eve?
Christmas Eve, not the day to be at that for sure. A special level of hell. Emmett Sussey there, played by Ewan McGregor. Yet another hell reference there in season three of Fargo. And that's my little potted history, if you like, of Fargo film and seasons one, two and three. And here we are now in season four. Began on Tuesday on T.G. Cahir. John McGuire and Arlene Hunt have been watching. How present, in fact, it's quite suitable to do that little potted history because that's how season four starts with a big potted history. But we'll come back to that. How present is the devil and his works in season four, Arlene Hunt?
There's definitely a supernatural element to season four. There's always been a sort of slightly fey feeling around the Fargos, but there's definitely more of a supernatural element to season four, and it's set in a different time as well. It's set in sort of November 1950s, so you're going way back ahead of all the Fargos that went before it. So it's a different time, you have different technology, you have different way of looking at things, different views of people, the tensions are very different, but there's a really creepy element all the way through it, and there's a couple of scenes in it that will actually make the hair on the back of your neck stand up. I don't want to give anything away because it's just starting out, but
yeah.
It's quite creepy in places.
Yeah, and John McGuire mentioned that episode one of season four, to set up what's going to be told in the 1950s, gives us a potted history of Chicago gangland.
Well, that's right. The focus, I am at a disadvantage here, I think, Sean, in that I've only watched one episode of season four. I am going to follow it with T.G. Cahir. So, Arlene, don't spoil it for me. What we have is the timeline haven't shifted back to the 1950s, but the location has moved 600 miles south of Fargo, North Dakota, to Kansas City, Missouri. And we start in the 1920s in a kind of where the Scandinavian immigrant population of North Dakota, all the Gundersons and Salversons of the previous seasons and the original film, has changed to the melting pot minority immigrant communities in the city, like the Irish and the Italians, the Jewish and the African Americans. And that's what in the first episode, we get that, like you did, a potted history of their mafias and their criminal syndicates and their criminal organizations and how they intersect through this very interesting device where a child from one of these criminal families, a boy child from one of these criminal families, is swapped with the other family, which I think is a kind of an ancient Irish Celtic kind of tradition that they would have done it sounds like it, even if it isn't. This is very Coen Brothers. Even if it isn't, it kind of sounds like it could be.
Yeah, but Arlene, what would
that device is used to?
Yeah, Arlene was going to come in that, Arlene.
I was just going to say it's the ward system where a family takes on a ward, and by taking on the ward, you raise the ward in your own family, and that sort of bestows peace upon the various different families or chieftains, as it was. And it was very popular. It was very popular in Irish history and Welsh history and early Celtic history, I think.
Yeah, it has a real mythological feel to it. It certainly gives that feeling to episode one. Let's have a listen to a clip, actually, from that early sequence, because our narrator through the historical or the telling of the history is a 16-year-old girl called Etherilda Pearl Smutney. And let's have a listen to her in her narrative mode or narrator mode.
And here's what you need to know about the people in that room. None of them were white. They were Dagos, Negroes, mixed, all fighting for the right to have been created equal. But equal to what? And who gets to decide? And that leads me to this conclusory idea, dear reader, which is that history is made up of the actions of individuals. And yet, none of us can know at the time we act that we are making history.
And that's the character of Ethelrilda Pearl Smutney, played by Emery Crutchfield in season 4 of Fargo. I said Chicago, I think. It's Kansas City, of course, is where we're brought up. It was because of the gangsters, I automatically thought Chicago, but it's Kansas City, quite definitely, that we're in for season 4. And John Maguire, this, if you Ethelrilda's family, it kind of picks up on what has been there as the whole Fargo motif, if you like. This idea of the innocent person, in this case, an entirely, it would seem, innocent family who got caught up in badness.
That's the common thread between these seasons, and it's that Coen brothers sensibility, the notion, like you say, Sean, that ordinary people can find themselves surrounded by violent and corrupting forces and must struggle and often fail to avoid getting caught up in it. And over the three seasons, which to me range from very, very good to outstanding, the mostly disconnected stories of Fargo's have been unified by that simple battle between good and evil. The good in our case now is going to be Ethelrilda, I think. She's this mixed-race 16-year-old high school student maths prodigy who by the end of the first episode finds herself already swept up in the latest chapter of the dark history of Kansas City. Kansas City being, of course, like you confused it with Chicago, but it does have this long tradition in film noir of being a place of corruption and gangsterism and crime. And it's a very, very rich, what Hawley has put together here is a very, very rich. It's actually hard to know where to start with his depiction of the world that he's brought us to in the 1950s. It's beautifully made. It's beautifully photographed.
Yeah, let me ask Arlene a little bit about the nature of that, the type of 1950s Kansas that we're given. It did really strike me. It's a very gangsterish type of place.
Yeah, there's a whiff of noir about it. It's very this between the outfits and the styles and the cars that everybody drives and the buildings and the cinematography on it is amazing. It's really, really well done. So you from the off, you get the sense that, you know, this is a time and a place, and you really feel that in this. This is the time. This is the place. And anything is on the table here. You know, you've got two warring families going against each other. You've got corrupt cops. You've got everyone driving these old Packards and things like that. It's just the minute you watch it, you're just removed from your, thankfully removed from your day-to-day existence.
And how surprising is it, Arlene, the casting of Chris Rock? We all know him as a stand-up comedian, essentially. And here he is playing the character of Loy Cannon, who's at the very heart of this gangster movement.
I actually thought he was really good in this because he's playing Chris Rock. Always to me is like various gears of Chris Rock, and when Chris Rock is in high gear, he's fast talking, fast thinking, fast everything. Here he's really, really buttoned down, and he has these amazing moments where he says absolutely nothing at all, but you can see the cogs whirring behind his eyes. You know, you can see, because he has to be like that because he's a black man in Kansas, in Missouri. In the 1950s, he's already despised by so many people there, and he's going to go to war against a Sardinian, basically an old school Sardinian mob. And it's, if you're going to be that man, if you're, and he's also a family man. So if you're going to be that, that spike, that's something that leads men and leads them into danger, you have to have everything buttoned down. You have to know what the next step is going to be. And he portrays that brilliantly because you don't know what he's thinking. He doesn't baffle. Doesn't talk much about what he's going to do next. He doesn't tell you what his next move is going to be. So it's really interesting to, especially as the series progresses, and it's really interesting to watch the development of that particular character.
And I must say, also his hairstyle, I don't know how, if that changes as the episode goes on, but there's something very frightening about the kind of, there's a bit of it sitting up at the front, and you think he's either totally insane and would turn on you and kill you in a flash, or he just has a crazy hairstyle, and I'm waiting to find out. But John, Hawley, the Noah Hawley, the writer, director and creator of the whole brainchild of the whole television series, which was quite a task to take on from the success of the film, if you like.
Yeah.
He's always had interesting actors. I mean, we heard from Billy Bob Thornton in the midst of our potted history. David Thewlis is there in previous seasons as well. And he continues with interesting actors in this season 4.
He does, and the first episode of it is so packed with characters and information, it often feels like we're zooming past important elements in the story, things that will be picked up later. It's very dense, and in order to put that across, you need the kind of A-list casting that he has. Chris Rock, Jesse Buckley plays a character I can't wait to see more of. Yeah. She's this kind of Munchausen's nurse who gets involved with Jason Schwartzman, who's one of the Fada family, the Sardinian gangsters. She gets involved with him. She has a very peculiar way of talking and an addiction to cocaine, and she's immediately a brilliant character. And alongside them, you have Jason Schwartzman, like I said, but in particular, it's Crutchfield, the 16, playing the 16-year-old, who seems like a real find and looks like she's going to be carrying much of the storytelling burden. Essentially, Ethel Reda is telling us what it takes to make it in America, an America that's very much against them and all the other minority groups that are trying to make their living by fair means and foul in Kansas yeah. City. And she's basically asking the question, if America is a nation of immigrants, then how does one become American? And it's a question posed by most of the characters yeah. at one point or another.
Let's listen to another clip then from season four. And this features Jesse Buckley as the nurse. She's meeting or making the acquaintance of Jason Schwartzman, Justo Fada, the son of the crime boss. And the crime boss himself is dangerously ill in St. Bartholomew's Hospital. And here is the chat between son of crime boss and nurse.
Oh, excuse me. Young fella, chuck wagon sorry. Coming through. Oh, God, don't be for sorry. What were you worrying and grieving?
Hey, you got any Bennies, Zoomers, a little chicken powder? You know, something to pick me up. I've had a world-class day.
Well, sir, those types of narcotics, when prescribed as a medical remedy, say as a mood elevator or to strengthen the concentration, can be quite effective, but ingesting them without the written prescription of a certified physician, that's not something I can help you with.
What if I share?
Holy Christmas.
And using illicit substances, it's very important to avoid obvious physical tells. Redness of the eyes, inflamed epidermal tissue, say around the proboscis.
You got a funny way of talking.
Yeah. I'm from Minnesota, land of 10,000 lakes.
No, I mean, you use big words.
Well, I have found in my 36 years in God's green earth that it's absolutely critical to be precise in your use of language so as to avoid instances of misreckoning. Well, I go. I should return to my ministrations.
You have a Bunsen burner?
Huh? No.
Bunsen burner to light cigarette. Jason Schwartzman and Jesse Buckley there in a scene from season four of Fargo. Arlene Hunt, her performance, Jesse Buckley's performance, I don't know if she can do anything wrong from anything I've seen her in recent times. Her performance is extraordinary in this.
She is magnificent in this. She's possibly my favourite character in this series. She is, just put aside anything you expect her to do, because she's going to surprise you in every single episode she's in. She's just amazing in this. She's got a funny way of moving, a funny way of talking. She's got this amazing wig. You know, everything about her just looks just off the charts, and you just get the sensation about it that you just don't know what she's going to do next. And that's exactly what she is. She's a pinball. She's a pinball, just ping, ping, ping all the series. She's so much fun to watch.
Yeah.
And the fact that you know, the Fado, the son gets involved with her is, as in all the Fargos, you can sort of see the road of destruction ahead. The moment these two characters collide, it's like, oh my God.
All right. Listen. You've seen all of it, or most of it, I think, Nardine. You want us to watch it. John, like me, can you wait to get past episode one?
No, I know it's repeated on Friday night on TG Cahir, and it's on the TG Cahir player, and on next Tuesday night at 10:30 on TG Cahir, and I'll be there for that. Yeah, I can't wait.
I'll be there with you for sure. That's Arlene Hunt and John McGuire there speaking to us about Fargo. First season, it repeated tomorrow, Friday night, TG Cahir. Season continues on Tuesday nights at 10:30 p.m. And as John told us, it's currently available on the TG Cahir player. Well, here we go again. The cinema's closed and we're back to virtual releases. Tonight we'll be speaking about Tyler Norwood, who's bringing us Robin's Wish, a documentary about the fascinating man that was Robin Williams, sadly died in 2014, and released today on Netflix, Pieces of a Woman, which stars Vanessa Kirby, Shia LaBeouf, struggling to come to terms with tragedy. Donald Clark, Ruth Barton have been looking at the films for us and they join me now. We'll start with Pieces of a Woman, Ruth. I don't know how you can describe the central performance here of Vanessa Kirby, but it's her story essentially. What's the basic setup here?
Well, with spoiler alerts, it's... so she's... she's with her partner, who's played by Shia LaBeouf. They're due their first baby, and they've decided on a home birth. She lives in Boston, though the film is actually shot in Montreal, and that setting is quite important to it. The midwife that they've booked can't make it, so the hospital sends out a replacement, who's played by Molly Parker. Things go wrong. The baby dies shortly after being delivered. And so this sets in train a whole series of events.
And even though you said spoiler alert, that's the opening gambit of the movie.
It isn't. I mean, I suppose what you have to say is there's about 30. I actually timed it. There's 30 minutes before the credits come up, and that pre-credit sequence of 30 minutes is nearly entirely taken up with what is pretty much a real-time giving birth sequence, and it's graphic.
And I saw Vanessa Kirby speaking about this, Donald, on the Graham Norton show, and I think it was there were two takes they did of this, and they did them as practically continuous takes, so that they might have had to stop and start very briefly, but there was no kind of we'll do a little bit now, we'll do another bit tomorrow. Does it have that real sense of reality in it from the very beginning, realness?
It does. I mean, that's always been... I mean, people are sometimes a bit dubious about the notion of excessive single takes, that they're a bit showy, and there's a suggestion that perhaps the director is kind of, grandstanding for the audience. But I think the single shot here really does have significance, because it gets across all kinds of things about how time progresses whenever you're under severe cases of stress. You get a better sense of the desperation, you get a better sense of the urgency. You also get a sense of how, during those sort of crises, time sometimes contracts and sometimes dilates. Certain seconds seem to go on forever and certain seconds seem to rush by in a panic. And it's a funny thing, as Ruth was saying, that trivial point, it sounds like we're giving away an awful lot of the film. This all happens before the credits arrive, which is after 30 minutes. I don't know if that's a record for a title arriving on the screen full 30 minutes, quarter way into the film, but I haven't looked that up, but I'll certainly be filing it away for future quizzes. But I think it's... it's hard to imagine how this film would look if you had different actors in it. It's one of those films that's so dominated by three performances, Shia LaBeouf, Ellen Burstyn, in particular Vanessa Kirby, that's impossible to kind of consider anything else. We do tend to often reduce ourselves to referencing early 1970s American cinema as if that's our last measure of a certain type of quality. But there's no getting away, I think, from those great performances by Gina Rowlands in John Cassavetes' work from that era, or indeed anything by Ellen Burstyn herself, who co-stars here as the principal character's mother. I think it's a really terrific performance. She hits every key with just the right force, if you can use a musical analogy. In that early sequence, during the home birth that goes wrong, she gets a chance to do proper physical acting, which she grasps with real enthusiasm. And it requires sort of the gifts of an athlete or a dancer to communicate all that pain and anguish, those knotted limbs and contorted faces. And there's a middle section where she gets to do these great duels with the surrounding actors, most notably Ellen Burstyn, which kind of almost feels like something from Ingmar Bergman, those great duels with Liv Ullmann or Harry Anderson or any of those actors. And then at the end, she has one of the great set pieces that all actors love. She gets a courtroom scene. We won't give any more details. Which is a courtroom sequence, which is what actors just love, because you have an opportunity to be just yourself in front of the camera.
A lot of shots.
She eats that up alive.
A lot of real close-ups of her face in that. But let's go to the middle section that you spoke about there, where she has several kind of tete-a-tetes, both with her mother and with her husband, the Shia LaBeouf character, but it's the one with the mother that I want to play, Ellen Burstyn and Vanessa Kirby. And the mother's worried whether the daughter is actually dealing with the loss that she's been through.
Her incompetence.
Is this about money?
No.
Is it about what people think?
It's about you. It's about you having to face this.
I am facing this. I am facing it! I am facing this!
Well, I don't think you are. We need some justice here.
No, you need. That is what you want. That is what you need. That is your way. That is not my way. That is what you need!
Martha, if you had done it my way, you'd be holding your baby in your arms right now.
You know what? You're ashamed. You are so ashamed of me. You're ashamed because I failed. Oh, what a disgrace. Oh, what a disgrace. I failed.
Oh, even listening back to it there, I haven't watched the film a couple of times actually at this stage, Pieces of a Woman, the Ellen Burstyn and Vanessa Kirby there as mother and daughter in a scene from that film. Ruth Barton, it's hugely upsetting and hugely difficult to watch, but for all the right reasons.
Yeah, I mean, that's a Gaspard moment where the mother says, if you'd done what I'd told you, you'd be holding your baby in your arms. You think, oh no, you couldn't say that. But I think it rings very true because there is, I mean, at the heart of this, a really interesting controlling relationship. And it centres around Ellen Burstyn, who, as it suggests, well, she's moneyed, she's old money of some sort. And I mean, so therefore, so is Martha, her daughter, and Sean isn't. So a lot of it's about the control that she exercises through her financial superiority, if you like. And although she says, oh, this isn't about money, you have to always ask yourself, how much is the court case that they do bring? I mean, they bring a court case against the midwife for failing to save the baby. And so you're always asking yourself, is it about money or is it about, status or who you are?
And Sean, the character you're speaking there is the Shia LaBeouf. That's the husband's character who's in the midst of that. But as we listen to that clip, it is all fire and there's a lot of energy in there. LaBeouf maybe a little bit more withdrawn in his reactions at times, Donald. But there is a melodramatic feel to this at times. Is that problematic?
There is, and some critics have been a bit uneasy about the fact that it is perhaps somewhat schematic and somewhat melodramatic. It certainly gives all the actors set pieces to exercise their particular talents. And certainly the film is laid out in pattern that moves from, as we said before, one schema to another schema to a third schema, which is very, very tightly structured in a way that life rarely is. But, I mean, that didn't worry me very much. This is a film. It's not real life, nor is it pretending to be, neorealism or anything. It originated as a play, and when you sometimes say you can see that in a film, that's often a bad thing. I don't mean that so much in this case. I simply mean that you can see that the roots for which it came from the drama to cinema. You can see that it stands or falls by its clashes between great acting talents. And I think that's going to prove useful for Netflix, who, to get vulgar about this momentarily, have been struggling over the last few years to finally get themselves noticed at the Oscars, and they won a few here and there. And I think they're going to get two Oscar nominations here pretty comfortably.
Vanessa Kirby and Ellen Burstyn. Okay, stars from you, Donald.
Four comfortably.
And what are you saying, Ruth?
I'm actually in the other camp. I think it hits too many melodramatic notes, and I also there seem to be some too many plot points stuck into it, and too many characters. Suzanne, for instance, the lawyer, seemed to me to be extraneous. I mean, I liked it very much, but it was a 3.5 for me. I just couldn't reach that 4.
All right, that's Pieces of a Woman, available on Netflix right now. Let's move on then to Robin's Wish, feature documentary which explores the death of the beloved actor in 2014 and the role that the undiagnosed condition of Lewy body dementia played in his death. Ruth, this is not a retrospective of Robin Williams's wonderful comic career. This really is a look at, it's a forensic examination of how he died.
It is, I didn't know what it was about before I watched it, so I was a little disappointed because I'd been expecting, I'd been expecting a documentary about Robin Williams with loads and loads of clips of his best moments. And if you expect that, you are going to be disappointed. So you really have to kind of refocus. As you say, this is almost like a kind of educational film in a sense, because it is all about this form of dementia, as you say, Lewy body dementia, which he had at his death but didn't know that he had. And so this brings on all kinds of symptoms like anxiety, memory loss, hallucinations, insomnia, and or something that is quite like Parkinson's. So he was told he had Parkinson's, but he suspected he had dementia, but he didn't know. And so what the film is doing is saying, okay, now that we know that he had dementia, this rare form of dementia, let's look back over his last years and see how it manifested itself. And they do that by interviewing the people who worked with him in his last films, his last TV, but very particularly his widow, Susan Schneider-Williams.
Well, let's listen to her then, speaking of her husband.
After he left, in his bedside table, there was a few items, just a few things. And every once in a while, I would pull that drawer open when I missed him and just wanted him to tell me something. I opened up that book and I was like, wow. When we were talking about what we wanted to be able to leave as our legacy. And for Robin, it was that he wanted to help people be less afraid.
And there we go, Susan Schneider-Williams in a clip there from Robin's Wish. Donald Clark, this is dealing obviously around the difficult subject of suicide as part of this story here. And I suppose the stigma around suicide, because there's a side here that they're very keen to push the suicide side, a part of the story, almost to one side.
Yeah, I mean, it's a campaigning documentary in a sense. It has a purpose, clearly shot in relatively low budget, which is interesting given that it comes from a family who's spending quite a lot of money. But but I think that's right. There's a purpose here. And the purpose here, to a large extent, is to shake off a lot of the yelled headlines that gathered around Robin Williams after his death. There was an awful lot of, blaming to an extent, but also a great deal of sentimentality gathered around this. A lot of misconceptions around it. A lot of talk about the clown who cried, you know, all that sort of stuff that you get dragged up whenever people discuss how difficult comedy can be on psychologically delicate people. It doesn't exactly come up with a simple solution to why he killed himself, but it does demonstrate that the real story is both simpler and more complicated.
And also,
we can't draw simple conclusions, but his widow wants to point out that people were writing all around this without knowing the facts, and the facts were that he had this degenerative condition related to Alzheimer's.
And that's important within that story. The other aspect of this is here, Ruth, it's essentially talking heads. Do we get a sense of the man outside of that comic world, if you like, or outside of that comic genius that is so often spoken about?
Yeah, I mean, what people repeatedly say is what a kind man he was, what a sensitive man he was. There's actually lovely archival footage of Christopher Reeves speaking of how loyal Robin Williams was to him after his own accident, you know, that led to his paralysis. And so there are those kind of moments. And also one of the things about it that the film, you know, repeatedly says is the reason he survived, if you like, or got so far with this disorder was that he was so intelligent that he had so much left of his brain still after it was being eaten away that he could function. And you see that intelligence coming through as well.
And thanks for battling the music in the background there. That's seeping through from elsewhere, I think, Ruth. So overall, is the documentary worth seeing, even though it isn't that retrospective that perhaps many people might be looking for when it comes to Robin Williams? You first, Donald, and quickly with stars on it.
I think it is. I mean, it's a humble film. It has, as I say, it has a particular purpose in mind. It achieves that quite nicely. You don't get a huge picture. You get some nice stuff as well on his home life in Marin County.
Yeah.
Though they do rather overstress their ordinariness, I think, his neighbours, for some people who are clearly enormously wealthy.
They have a few bob to be ordinary with.
Exactly.
Stars.
But a sincere film, and I give it 3 stars.
Three from you. What are you saying, Ruth?
Yeah, three from me as well. Worthy, and it's kind of okay.
All right. Tyler Norwood, the director there, Robin's Wish, the second film we were speaking about, and Pieces of a Woman, the first, that Donald Clark and Ruth Barton were reviewing for us on this Thursday evening, bringing us to the end of tonight's programme. Paula Shields, Liam Murphy researched, Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator, Kieran Dunn was on sound this evening, and tonight's programme produced by Kay Sheehy. Talk to you tomorrow night at 7.